As commented on by Dr. Buzdar, aromatase inhibitors have been demonstrated in a variety of settings to result in greater disease control than tamoxifen in postmenopausal patients. I met with Dr. Tony Howe, the principal investigator of the ATAC trial and a central figure in the evolution of endocrine therapy over the last three decades. I asked Dr. Howe to provide an update on clinical research in this important area, and he began our discussion by commenting on the ATAC bone data that was presented at the 2006 ASCO meeting.
The bone data are very important because these are the first five-year data of the aromatase inhibitors, and it shows quite a marked loss on anastrozole over the 5 years. This is anastrozole for 5 years versus tamoxifen for 5 years, remember, in the ATAC trial. It shows an 8%, 7 to 8% loss over the 5 years. And in the lumbar spine, it's about that, but it sort of levels off slightly after 2 years, whereas in the hip, it goes straight down to 8%. And that's obviously a problem. It looks as though you'd be able to prevent that with bisphosphonates. But the very important clinical point that came out was that if a woman started with a normal bone density, none of those women became osteoporotic over the 5 years. So you can do your bone density measurement up front, and, well, I guess the data would need to be confirmed, but it's a reasonable number of patients, and that you almost certainly won't get osteoporotic over the 5 years. If you start with osteopenia, some of those women went osteoporotic, so you need to follow those up fairly carefully.
What do we know right now about how effective bisphosphonates are preventing this bone loss?
Well, we're beginning to get quite a bit of data, actually. I mean, I think the most important data remain the Austrian data, which will be published in JCO shortly. And, of course, they showed that zoledronate given 4 milligrams 6 monthly completely abrogated the bone loss, which was presented 2 or 3 years ago now by Michael Nant. But there are other data from Sheffield which show that ibandronate given orally can prevent the bone loss on aromatase inhibitors. So I think we'll see a number of other data coming through showing that you can prevent loss with the bisphosphonates, although we need to be absolutely sure about that.
You know, another thing that has come out in the last couple of years has been this whole issue of delayed use of aromatase inhibitors, particularly from the MA17 trial and letrozole. Yeah. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about management of women who've had tamoxifen in the past or who've never had endocrine therapy for whatever reason. Yes. Maybe theoretically they should have and refused it or whatever. Yeah. What do you think is a reasonable approach to patients like that clinically?
Well, I think that the data showing that the ER positives tend to relapse late, that's really quite convincing. And I think Paul Goss has done a good job in showing that. And clinically, it seems appropriate that you might, even if a patient hasn't had any endocrine therapy, hasn't had tamoxifen, and she's, say, node positive, I don't know why she would not have had tamoxifen, but say she did, it seems appropriate to start the aromatase inhibitor on a one-off basis. We don't have data strictly in that clinical situation, although in New Zealand and Australia, they're just starting up a late introduction trial, even if there's been no treatment in the situation we're just discussing, or if there's been quite a gap between tamoxifen and starting up. So we'll be getting those data some years from now, I guess, but on a one-off basis, it seems to be a logical thing to do. I think the data from MA17 are quite convincing.
Another strategy that's been discussed in the U.S., I think within the CALGB, is the idea of using delayed Faslodex fulvestrant. And I'm not sure if they're going to move forward with that, but
yes.
What do you think about that?
That's an interesting issue. If you've had 5 years of an AI, why not change over to something? And it would be somewhere where Faslodex could go. So that is a trial which is being seriously considered at the moment. And it should be effective. It gets around having an AI for too long. If you had 5 years of an AI, what do you do then? And obviously, some people say go on for AIs for 15 years. That just seems pretty tough. And ultimately, I guess we may end up by giving a series of different treatments in the way that Craig Jordan has shown in his animal models. You might give a bit of estrogen, a bit of anti-estrogen, a bit of AI in a sequence, but that will take some time to work out.
Anything developing in terms of predictors of late relapse to try to guide who to treat?
No, I don't think there is at the moment. I think it's pretty difficult because you get late relapses in node positive, late relapses in node negative, irrespective of tumour type. So I don't think we have anything to indicate who to treat at the moment.
In terms of fulvestrant, now we have the initial results from the EFFECT trial being presented. Can you describe what that trial looked at and what's being seen?
Well, that trial compared fulvestrant versus exemestane after failure of previous aromatase inhibitors. So it was given second or third line in advanced disease, or you could go in after you've had an aromatase inhibitor as an adjuvant. And so the response rate was identical. The clinical benefit rate was identical between the two arms of that study, about a 20% response rate in each arm. I think it just indicates the difficulty of doing these studies because 80% of those patients were non-contributory. And it's difficult to see a difference, I think, even if there is a difference when you only get 20% responding. And so there could be a serious problem with a type 2 error there. Either way, either exemestane is better than fulvestrant or fulvestrant is better than exemestane. But as it stands at the moment from that trial, there's no difference. So if you want to give a simple treatment, you give exemestane. If you want to give a difficult treatment, you give the injections of fulvestrant.
Can you talk about the other studies, and particularly the SOFIA trial and what they're looking at?
The FACT and the SWOG study are looking at the combination of anastrozole and fulvestrant versus anastrozole alone after failure of a SAM, such as tamoxifen. And these studies are crucially important. Angela Brody has data suggesting that the combination of letrozole and Faslodex, fulvestrant, is highly effective in her MCF7 aromatase gene-transfected immune-deprived mouse tumor model, so that in that model, fulvestrant delays tumors for a certain period of time, letrozole for a certain period of time, but when you put both together, you don't get tumors. And those are the only data that we have that the combination of a SERD, a selective estrogen receptor downregulator, and an aromatase inhibitor might be good together. As we know from the ATTACK trial that a SERM and aromatase inhibitor are no good together, but the SERD may be different. So these three trials, that's the SWOG, the FACT, and SOFIA, are crucially important to the further development of fulvestrant. They will show whether the combination of an AI plus fulvestrant is better than an AI alone in advanced disease. Both SWOG and the FACT trial are doing just that. The SOFIA trial is different. It's a three-arm study. It's exemestane versus fulvestrant plus an AI. So that will give another look at whether the fulvestrant is better than exemestane, but it'll also give another look at whether the combination is better than a single agent. The only difference between this trial and the other two trials is that the patients would have been on an AI just before going on to fulvestrant. And the idea is that you go on to fulvestrant by itself or you continue the AI with fulvestrant, because there is this question of whether fulvestrant is the right dose and would it work in the presence of the increased estrogen that you would have if you came off the AI for advanced disease. And so that's what this trial is trying to examine, whether maintaining a low estrogen is beneficial for fulvestrant effect.
Can you talk a little bit about the mechanism of action of fulvestrant and the AIs and what you think would happen with the two together and how that might be different than a SERM like tamoxifen plus an AI?
Yeah, I think that the major difference is thought to be what happens when the SERM or the SERD binds to the estrogen receptor. When tamoxifen binds the receptor, it goes to the estrogen response element of the appropriate genes, and it sits there. Now, it sits there and can be influenced. It can inhibit the gene activity, but it sits there, and the estrogen receptor can be activated by growth factors through phosphorylation of activating factor 1. Whereas the idea is that the SERD causes downregulation of the receptor, is degraded, and doesn't sit on the ERE, and therefore growth factors can't act through phosphorylating activating factor 1. So you've got two agents in the aromatase inhibitor plus fulvestrant combination. You've got one agent i.e. the aromatase inhibitor, keeping estrogen low, stopping estrogen going to the ERE, and if it gets there, you've got the SERD causing degradation so that presumably growth factor activity can't act via activating factor 1 and phosphorylation of that activating factor. Now, that works in Brody's model. The combination works in Brody's model, and the real question is it acting in women? And it's going to take another year before we get the results of the three trials I've been talking about.
My simplified understanding of this has been that fulvestrant is a competitive inhibitor. You mentioned the issue of dose and the idea to try to overcome that by increasing the dose. Would removing the ligand kind of being the same kind of strategy?
Well, exactly. That's the sort of rationale behind the SOPHIA trial. You're maintaining a low estrogen level in that trial. And so you either reduce the estrogen level or you increase the dose or possibly both. And there is this problem of not knowing the precise way to give fulvestrant despite all this time. Should you give a loading dose? Should you give continuous 500 milligrams? And we'll get some insight into that from the Weiner trial of neoadjuvant, 3 months of 500 milligrams versus 3 months of 250 milligrams. That might give us some clue as to the influence of dose fairly soon.
What about Mike Dixon's work looking at premenopausal patient and bumping the dose up?
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
That's a seriously interesting. Mike Dixon's stuff was seriously interesting because he was asking the question, can we make fulvestrant work in premenopausal women? And so he calculated, and the AZ people calculated, that if you gave 750 milligrams, i.e. three injections, because you can't get any more than 250 milligrams into 5 mil of the oily suspension, so you have to give three injections to get in 750. And he did show some reduction in Ki-67 in a preoperative model. So, on the other hand, you just can't give, I don't think, three injections for any period of time. And it's much easier to cut down estrogen by gosserelin or oophorectomy rather than giving three injections to get around the endogenous estradiol in those situations.
Has that been done, looking at ovarian suppression or ablation plus fulvestrant?
Has been done in advanced disease, and it's active, done by John Robertson. So that may be the way to go for advanced disease, but also ultimately maybe a way to go for the adjuvant situation. In terms of adjuvant fulvestrant, I think there are difficulties here because, okay, the adjuvant trial to do would be an AI versus AI plus fulvestrant for 3 or 5 years, and the National Cancer Institute of Canada have a protocol for just that, ready to go. But you don't want to go unless you've got a signal. And the signal would come from one of those three trials that we discussed earlier. And we won't get that signal for another year, I don't think.
In a way, it reminds me a little bit of the work that's been done in advanced disease looking at ovarian suppression plus an AI. Now we have a couple of studies that have looked at that. And I guess bottom line is you're making the woman postmenopausal and giving her the best postmenopausal therapy.
Yes, we have no data in the adjuvant situation, we do in the advanced situation. As you know, that three small studies all showing effectiveness of that combination of ovarian suppression plus an AI. The real question is what happens in the adjuvant situation. Of course, lots of people are currently treating premenopausal women with something like Zoladex plus an AI because they think it will be better, but there's no data to support that. And of course, the Austrian trial is the one which will give us the answer. They've completed recruitment to that trial for over 2,000 patients, gosserelin plus tamoxifen versus gosserelin plus an AI. And the data should be presented next San Antonio. And they are ahead of the game. Those are the only data, to my knowledge, that will come out soon-ish.
We're hearing more talk about crosstalk between ER pathway and HER2 pathway. We have the tandem data that's been presented looking at anastrozole plus trastuzumab. What are your thoughts about that study and the whole general concept of this crosstalk?
The crosstalk clearly occurs. It occurs in animal models. That's a strong argument from the animal models, and particularly a strong arguer for that is Kent Osborne, of course. And he's got some very beautiful data, a combination of inhibiting the estrogen receptor and inhibiting HER2. And Richard Pietras has also got some very nice data. the in vitro and the animal data, certainly for HER2, look very strong. So the trial which was reported on anastrozole plus trastuzumab versus anastrozole alone shows an advantage of the combination. So you've got a signal there. But then the question is, we need more of that sort of data, but what about the other signal transduction inhibitors? We have a combination of letrozole plus the mTOR inhibitor, teriflunomide. That was the combination versus letrozole. And that trial was, I'm afraid, disappointing in that there was no difference between those two arms. And several studies along those lines have not looked very promising. And so that avenue is problematical, except perhaps for lapinitib or Herceptin plus the AI. And I think the reason for all that is that if you look at in vitro with MCF7 cells, you find that they block one pathway or two pathways and they start up another pathway. These cells can get around blocks pretty efficiently, certainly blocks in signal transduction between the cell surface and the nucleus.
Let's talk a little bit about prevention. You're the head of the IBIS-2 trial. Can you talk a little bit about, first of all, where we are with IBIS-1 that's now reporting some long-term data, what's being looked at in IBIS-2, and what other strategies you're interested in?
The data on long-term effects of tamoxifen are clearly very important. There are four trials out there, but only two of them will be able to give really good long-term data, which are uncontaminated by women who are on the control arm taking treatment, as happened in P1. Clearly, P1 is a very, very important study, large numbers, and in the relatively short period of treatment that patients had, they showed a 50% reduction. Very, very important study. But there are two studies reported at San Antonio which ask the question, what happens when you stop treatment? And what would you predict? Would you get a carryover effect or would you not get a carryover? The answer is you get a carryover effect. It really is absolutely fascinating. And first of all, the IBIS-1 study. 7,000 women in that study, and they were continued blinded after stopping treatment after 5 years. And the data are being presented by Jack Cusick showing that 30 to 40% reduction continues out to 10 years, and the toxicity goes down. The problem of endometrial cancer goes away, the problem of deep vein thrombosis goes away, other problems of flushes all go away. So you're left with a net benefit, I think, in the end. So it's led us to reconsider the view that we have on tamoxifen and potentially go back to our medicines control agency and say, look, let's reconsider this drug as a preventive agent. The data are supported by the Royal Marsden trial, which Trevor Powles is going to present. That was a randomized trial of 8 years of tamoxifen versus placebo. And after stopping tamoxifen, he's shown that there is a 50% reduction beyond stopping tamoxifen, which is clearly another carryover effect. So we've got two trials showing a carryover effect, which I think is very important for prevention. It's made us look at it in a different light.
What about IBIS-2?
IBIS-2 is obviously a logical trial to do, as is MA3. IBIS-2, of course, is anastrozole versus placebo, and MA3, exemestane versus placebo. Both trials are recruiting reasonably. IBIS-2 needs 6,000 women and MA3 needs about 4,500 to 5,000 women. And the important data to be presented from the point of view of IBIS-2 at this meeting is cognitive function. I was particularly worried that there would be a decline in cognitive function on anastrozole. And we've shown in over 200 patients, placebo versus anastrozole, the first patients put into IBIS-2, after 6 months, there's absolutely no difference in cognitive function. And these women had very carefully controlled 10 different cognitive function tests, and there's absolutely no difference between the two. And I find this very reassuring. Obviously, we've got to continue with that, and the patients will be continued out to 5 years of follow-up. They have another test at 2 years and another test at 5 years. But to date, the cognitive function is reassuring.
What about the other part of IBIS-2, looking at DCIS?
That's also obviously an important study that sets anastrozole versus tamoxifen in ER-positive DCIS. We don't think it's worth treating ER-negative DCIS from the NSAVP data that presented in abstract form. And so that trial is going around the world, except I think in the United States, and is recruiting reasonably.
I guess NSAVP already closed their trial looking at the same question.
Yeah.
What do you think that's going to show?
Don't know.
You know, one
it should show an advantage to the aromatase inhibitor, of course.
One of the things that came out recently, obviously, in terms of prevention was the STAR trial. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, the STAR trial is fantastic. It's an amazing feat to get that number of women into a comparison of tamoxifen and raloxifene. And it gives an extraordinarily interesting and, to some extent, counterintuitive result. Because the more core study suggests, obviously, that raloxifene would be pretty good. In those studies, you're getting, what, about a 70% reduction in recurrence. Obviously, they're a population who are different from the STAR trial because they had osteoporosis. STAR trial is women who are at increased risk because of increased Gale score, mainly because of a family history, some ADH, some LCIS. And for invasive cancer, there's absolutely no difference at all, as we all know from the result in JNCI this year. So that's counterintuitive to a certain extent, because we expected raloxifene to be better than tamoxifen from the core trial. But the other interesting thing is that there is a greater effect on DCIS with tamoxifen rather than raloxifene. And you get exactly the same result in the Ruth trial, which, remember, that was in cardiovascular disease. That DCIS wasn't reduced in that, and you get exactly the same effect in the more core studies. So that it, for reasons which I can't understand, raloxifene does not look all that effective in DCIS. And the question, of course, is it suppressing tumors that have already invaded and not suppressing DCIS? It just seems counterintuitive, and I can't understand it. But that's the result. So the data show that raloxifene is equivalent to tamoxifen. I think that that's in terms of invasive breast cancer. So then you have to look to see whether it has fewer side effects, and obviously it does. And so it's the agent of choice for the prevention of postmenopausal women at risk of breast cancer.
What are some of the other initiatives that are going on right now in prevention that you think are promising?
Well, there's Powell Brown stuff on retinoids, targretin, because we need to know how to prevent ER-negative breast cancer. Very interesting data from Mike Sporn, the combination in model systems of rexinoids plus azoxifene. And the question is whether you should put that into further prevention trials. And I think that we need to wait for the targretin studies before we consider starting up those studies. There's also obviously been considerable interest in looking at lifestyle changes. Lots of data coming out now that weight gain between 20 and 50 is bad news for postmenopausal breast cancer. And we published last year that women in the Iowa Women's Health Study who lost 5% of their body weight had about a 40% reduction of postmenopausal breast cancer if they lost their weight premenopausally. Some of our studies are looking at ways of getting women at risk to lose weight. One of our studies is a continuous calorie restriction versus intermittent calorie restriction study, because we feel that it may be easier to induce women to do intermittent calorie restriction. That study is nearly completed now, and we'll be reporting that probably in next San Antonio.
And what exactly is the intervention? What do you have them
well,
do?
Well, we simply reduce the amount of food they eat. As simple as that. As a 25% continuous calorie restriction.
For how long?
In this study, 6 months.
6 months.
And in the other arm of the study, there's 2 days of calorie restriction out of 7 days. Now, you may say that sounds a rather strange thing to do, but there are some human data suggesting that you can do that, and we are doing it. But there are two or three animal studies which are really interesting, that intermittent calorie restriction is superior in some animal model systems to continuous calorie restriction. Now, why that is, we don't know, but it's a very interesting phenomenon which we're trying to repeat in women.
What are some of the mechanisms that might be contributing to this?
I think that very, very interesting biochemical data coming out. The control of the metabolism is through a very key enzyme called AMP-related kinase. And calorie restriction increases that kinase. That turns off anabolic pathways and increases catabolic pathways. So you turn off synthesis of fats, you turn off synthesis of proteins, and you break them down. That enzyme works by inhibiting mTOR pathways, and that turns off cell proliferation. And you can show this in animal models. And the very interesting thing is calorie restriction mimetics, which are coming through. Basically, they work through this pathway. It's a very interesting paper on MCF7 growth in nude mice, which was turned off by inhibiting that pathway with 2-deoxyglucose. Now, you can't give 2-deoxyglucose to people because it has a cardiotoxic effect in animals, but it's a proof of principle that turning off that pathway with 2-deoxyglucose works in terms of inhibiting tumor growth of MCF7 cells in the nude mouse model. And there are other mimetics coming through. For example, metformin looks as though it works by similar mechanisms. And in fact, we may be able to prevent breast cancer with metformin.
That's fascinating. Has turning off estrogen ever been looked at, either in laboratories or people, intermittently?
No. Intermittent reduction of estrogen is something which some people, such as myself, have advocated for a long period of time. So I think it's Jim Ingle. And I think Craig Jordan might say the same thing. But this is what might be happening. For example, when you give goserelin for a couple of years after surgery for breast cancer, you know those studies, the Zebra study, for example, 2 years goserelin, same as CMF, and the German initiated study. And what you're doing there is switching off estrogen actually for 2 years, then you stop. Those periods restart in a large proportion of women. That's been shown quite well by that group. And then, of course, you go into a menopause later. So you've switched off, you switch back on again, and you switch off. So it may be that that's the mechanism of the relatively good results of those several trials which use short-term ovarian suppression.
Speaking of diet, what are your thoughts about the WINS study looking at dietary fat reduction as a means to decrease relapse rate in women who already have breast cancer?
That's presented by Ram Tabaski. That's a seriously interesting study and a difficult study to do and extremely well done by that group and giving very interesting results, which are absolutely real. I think it's 11% reduction. I think that's right. And then, of course, they do a subgroup analysis and show that it's an ER negative rather than ER positive. Well, that may be right. But the trial, I'm not taking away from the beauty of the trial. Very difficult trial to do, very well done by a very good group of investigators. But in the fat restriction arm, they lost about 5 pounds in weight. And in the control arm, they gained about 5 pounds in weight. So that's overall 5 + 2 = 7. That's a half a stone in weight. And we know from the epidemiological data that I studied that I told you that we did, if you lost 5% of body weight, you would reduce your risk of breast cancer. So we don't know whether it's due to fat or whether it's due to weight loss. I can tell you my view, and I think it's weight loss. And the Women's Health Initiative study not showing much effect of fat restriction suggests that. But I guess, you know, the old adage is that we need more data to see what's happening. Now, I know that there is a calorie restriction study being organized, and that will be very important to try and tease out this issue of whether it's calorie restriction or fat restriction. My guess is it's likely to be calorie restriction.
If that strategy is affecting relapses in ER-negative patients, any thoughts about how insulin growth factor has been discussed? What are your thoughts?
Whether it is ER-negative or no is a moot point. I mean, it's a subgroup analysis, and obviously we have to be careful. But if it is, my feeling is that you are in some way energy restricting these women, and you come back to the mechanisms that I've already discussed about energy restriction, which is known. If you energy restrict an animal, you turn off cell proliferation. And we've got a biochemical mechanism which shows us this, that if you put up AMP-related kinase, that switches off mTOR, and that signal transduction pathway, growth goes down.
Any other topics that you'd like to talk about?
Well, it's just the overall WHI study. I think that's done a tremendous job in sorting out the HRT issue. I think the most interesting result from that is that estrogen premarin alone showing a near significant reduction in breast cancer. That's a big counterintuitive. But it does indicate, first, that progesterone is possibly a large part of the problem in terms of induction of breast cancer. So the combined pill is the problem. And the natural secretion of progesterone in premenopausal women may be a problem. And that's possibly why we get if you do an oophorectomy in women age 40, you halve the risk of breast cancer. And it's possibly why when you do that in BRCA1 and BRCA2 mutation carriers and then add back estrogen, the epidemiological studies from Rebecca and others show that you don't increase the risk of breast cancer. So that whole story is hanging together very nicely, that low-dose estrogen add back for women who have a premature menopause probably is not going to increase your risk of breast cancer, will improve the woman's quality of life, and has helped us in our thinking about ways to prevent premenopausal breast cancer.
What about the use of low-dose estrogen in breast cancer patients in terms of management of menopausal symptoms?
Low-dose estrogen in those women is problematical. I mean, obviously, we've got the trials from Scandinavia, which suggest probably that it causes relapse. It's the usual thing that a randomized study shows one thing and the sort of previous epidemiological collect women on estrogen after surgery for breast cancer didn't show this effect. So it is probably a problem, and it is even a greater problem if you're going to be on aromatase inhibitors, because any estrogen is certainly problematical.